These voices spoke to the lonely woman of the spirit world, its joys, its home life, and its duties, so vivid did they appear to her that she would remember and repeat them to her husband in her waking hours. At length the lady began to declare her belief that God had permitted her little one to return to her in her hours of sleep, to comfort her in her sore affliction, and truly did she seem to grow calm and happy in mind, even though her body became more delicate and fragile. Anxious for his wife's health, and fearful lest her mind was becoming unbalanced, Mr. Harris consulted with his family physician concerning her strange condition. The doctor examined the lady, and pronounced her of sound mind. He declared the nervous system, however, to be shattered, and recommended travel as a means of restoration to health. About this time, Mrs. Harris received a letter from her sister and husband living in the West, urging her and Mr. Harris to visit them in their far-off home. After mature deliberation on the part of our friends, it was decided to accept the cordial invitation extended by their relatives, the Websters, and they accordingly prepared to leave their home for the West, as soon as the spring should open and render traveling comfortable and easy. Dreams that appeared strange. One morning, or soon after the above decision was made, and Mrs. Harris appeared at the breakfast table in a preoccupied state of mind, which her husband noticed, and which elicited inquiry from him as to its cause. "I will tell you," said the lady. "You remember Mrs. Stevens, the seamstress I used to employ to do my plain sewing? Well, the last time she was here I noticed she labored very hard for breath, and fearing that she had taken a violent cold, I paid her her due, and advised her to go home and attend to herself. It was the time Freddy was so very ill, and in my anxiety for him I forgot all about the poor woman, until about 6 weeks ago I sent for her to come to me, when I learned for the first time of her death at the hospital, which occurred last winter. A.O. wondered what had become of her little boy, but supposed he had been taken care of by friends. You remember what a liking our Freddy took to the little fellow, and how he always begged to be allowed to show him some toys and give him cake whenever his mother brought him with her. A.O. Well, for the last 3 nights I have seen Mrs. Stevens as plainly as I ever saw her in my life, but with a look of distress on her face that she never wore in my presence. Last night, our Freddy was with her, and I heard him say, 'A.O., Mama, her Georgie is in trouble. He is not treated well, he is unhappy, and it makes her so too. I like Georgie, and I want you to find him and make him happy, as I am happy in this lovely world. A.O. the,' continued the lady, 'I have told you my dream. I promised Freddy I would do what I could for the little Stevens boy, but I don't know where he is, I am sure. However, I am certain I have had a visit from the dead, and I feel that I must keep my promise.' This occurrence convinced Mr. Harris that his wife's sanity depended upon his taking her away from home immediately, and so quickly did he push his preparations for departure that the end of another week found them fairly started on their long journey. We do not propose to enter into the details of the trip, nor of their welcome to their sister's home. The expectations of Mr. Harris seemed about to be realized. The excitement of the journey, the change of scene and of atmospheric influences, appeared to exert a beneficial effect upon his wife. The extreme degree of lassitude, formerly so frequent with her, departed. Her step became firmer, her eye clearer, her voice more cheerful. Her appetite also began to improve, her new life seemed full of interest to her, and, best of all, in her husband's opinion, Anne no more was heard from her of nightly vision and visiting spirit. It was a beautiful morning in summer, when Mrs. Harris startled her husband by exclaiming, "I had a visit from Mrs. Stevens again last night, who said to me, 'Remember your promise, my child is in trouble, he will be brought to you ere 24 hours have gone over your head, I trust you to take care of him.' And when she passed from my sight, our Freddy came, looking so beautiful that I almost cried aloud, so anxious was I to hold him in my arms, and he said, 'Dear Mama, I come to you in this way, for I love you, and I want you to see how happy I am in the spirit world. I love you and Papa dearly, but I don't want to come back here to live. You will come to me by and by, but I want you to have a little boy here to love and care for, and we will bring you Georgie Stevens. The cruel man beats and curses him. You and Papa must love him, and teach him of God and the angels. He will be their gift to you. The lady ceased speaking, and the husband stood looking upon her in silence. The sweetness and solemnity in her tones impressed him deeply, yet a terrible fear that his wife had become insane filled his soul with speechless sorrow. The strange dreams fulfilled. It was the evening of the same day that Mrs. Webster sat watching for her husband's return from the distant city. He was late, and anxious fears for his safety disturbed the serenity of her mind. Mr. and Mrs. Harris had retired, but not to rest, for the minds of both were disturbed, either one over her vision of the night before, the other over the condition of his wife. It was near the midnight hour when at length Mr. Webster arrived, bearing a burden, at the form of an unconscious child found by him on the roadside. The noise and bustle of the arrival aroused Mr. Harris, who decided to investigate. Judge of his surprise to find his brother-in-law burdened with a waif of apparently 9 years of age, A1, too, whose sunburned features seemed strangely familiar to him. Actuated by a feeling of uneasiness, Mrs. Harris wrapped a light shawl around her, and also descended to the lower part of the house to ascertain why her brother had been detained so late. No sooner had the eyes of the lady rested upon the face of the child who had been conveyed to a bedroom and placed upon the couch, where Mrs. Webster was now attending to him, than she started forward, exclaiming, "Oh, it is Georgie Stevens." In a moment her husband was beside her, and as he, too, gazed upon the form before him, the conviction fastened upon his mind that it was no other than the little boy whom he had more than once seen in his own house, and whom he knew to be the son of a poor yet worthy woman employed in former times by his wife as a seamstress. A startled silence fell upon all in that apartment, for each one present knew of the strange dreams that had visited Mrs. Harris, and as the stillness deepened, a peculiar light shone above the face of the fever-tossed child, which formed into letters, and then words, until the sentence, "Ao God's and the angel's gift," could be read, and having been read slowly faded from sight. When the fever abated, and little Georgie returned to consciousness, he found himself cared for by loving friends, who had accepted their charge reverently and gladly, and when he became able to relate the story of his miserable life in the West, under the persecutions of his cruel master, the confirmation of the spirit's statements to Mrs. Harris was received. In a little while the child was able to travel, and he was taken by Mr. and Mrs. Harris to their eastern home, for these good people had determined to adopt and educate him as their son. Through these occurrences, Mr. Harris sought to investigate spiritualism, which he did to his satisfaction, receiving unbounded evidence of its truth. His wife still continues to have visions and to hold communion with the spirits, and her soul is happy and at rest. Little Georgie, now a youth who bids fair to make a mark in the world, has never seen his own mother since the night he followed her spirit from the home of his tormentor, but he delights to receive tidings of her watchful care over him from the lips of his beloved second mother, Mrs. Harris, who often holds communion with her spirit in the silence of the midnight hour. Chapter 10. Lucy Aiken's Mission. In relating to you these incidents in illustration of the work of the spirit, and its influence upon mortals, you are not to suppose that they are fictitious. A truth is ever stranger than fiction, and the events of daily occurrence in the lives of human beings are more marvelous, more significant, in their bearings toward the mission and destiny of individuals than any tale of novelist can possibly seem to be, while, in reality, he who weaves his web of fiction, filled with startling scenes and incidents, with which to regale his readers, finds the foundation of all that is most real, startling and beautiful in his romance in the passing events of daily realistic life. Yet another instance will we relate to you of the earnestness, depth of feeling, intensity of power, and persevering patience displayed by spirits in the pursuance of the work they have to perform for the benefit of mortals. A terrible accident had happened in one of your large cities. A factory boiler exploding had dealt destruction all around, but by far the saddest result of the catastrophe might be seen in an upper room of a tenement house not far away. A man, once strong and active, but now reduced to a mere skeleton, lay breathing the hours away in misery and pain. His spine had been seriously injured from the effects of the explosion, rendering him a helpless invalid, but not mercifully inflicting upon his body a fatal injury. Ah, no. Doomed to live, in agony and pain, deprived of strength, the days rolled by bringing no cheer to his soul save the blithesome presence, at morn and evening, of his cheery-faced young daughter, who, in her frail person, alone stood between him and starvation. This young girl of 16 summers was employed in a cotton mill, where, from morning till night, she toiled for the small sum of $4 per week, out of which she was compelled to buy food for herself and parent, pay the rent of their humble tenement, and provide medicine for the invalid. After this had been accomplished, it would seem that nothing could remain for clothing, and yet Katie was always neatly clad in clean but coarse garments of her own manufacture. Time passed, and our cheerful young friend found herself wearing out and breaking down under the burdens imposed upon her. Health gave way. Her strength became exhausted, and at length a distressing cough set in, which the dispensary doctor, who attended her father, declared to be the herald of incipient consumption. It seemed that her work at the mill must be given up, but if this was done, what would become of her invalid father, as well as of herself? Ah, who could tell? Unseen helpers. Thus matters stood with those of whom we write at the commencement of our story. Katie still kept at her post, in spite of pain and fatigue, and despite the remonstrances of physician and others, and it was found that she could accomplish as much labor, and perform it as satisfactorily, as the strongest and smartest hand in the place. The cause of this amount of endurance on the part of a fragile girl, whose every breath was fraught with pain, was a mystery to all who knew her, but not so to the angels. They brought her the power, day by day, to accomplish her work to the satisfaction of all. They magnetized her weary frame night after night, thus holding the ravages of disease at bay, even though they could not deliver her from suffering and pain. The humblest of God's children have spirit friends and attendants, as well as the highest and grandest. Spirits who watch over, guide, and direct those under their charge are with the poor and lowly as well as with the wealthy and great. None are forsaken, none forgotten, all are cared for and blessed with angel ministrations. In this case, the spirit mother of Katie brought strength and power to the girl, aided by wise and good magnetic physicians of spirit life, who loved to benefit the needy and soothe the suffering. And the father, upon his bed of pain, was enabled to behold his daughter attending to his wants, ministering to his necessities, and caring for him in every loving way. Surely a sight to cause rejoicing among the angels, who delight to behold good deeds and noble acts performed for others. A spirit's efforts to reach her father. Katie's father met with the disaster that had injured him for life at a factory, or rather a mill, owned by a corporation, the president of which, a stern, overbearing man, had but a few years before lost a lovely and only daughter of 14 summers. This beautiful spirit had long sought to influence her father, in order to convince him of her continued existence, but all in vain. Until now she had turned her attention to the needs and necessities of the lowly and suffering, and had entered heart and soul into the work of relieving their distress. For 10 weeks following the accident, the corporation of which we write paid the expenses of the suffering man, but at the expiration of that time all help from that quarter ceased, and, as we have said, there was no resource but Katie's scant earnings for the needs of the invalid and herself. Lucy, the spirit daughter of the rich man at the head of the mill, had become cognizant of these facts, and, being strongly attracted to Katie, sought in every possible way to lighten her burdens. She now redoubled her efforts to reach and influence her father, for she felt that something must be done for the relief of the young working girl and the suffering man. As yet her efforts were uncrowned with success, but still she continued them unceasingly, for she felt that it was her mission to penetrate the crust of worldliness that had gathered around her father's spirit, and to draw him upward toward the higher and the better life. Time passed. In spite of all that attending spirits could do, Katie was surely breaking down under the wearing labor imposed upon her, for the physical system could not withstand the strain brought to bear upon it. One day she fainted at her work, and it was a full hour before she was brought to her senses by the efforts of the frightened girls who clustered around her. Then, weak and pallid, she was taken home, to be placed under the care of a physician who was in attendance upon her father. This was a time of sore trial to the members of that little family, but, although they knew it not, spirit helpers were working for their benefit. 2 weeks had passed since the day that Katie had left her work at the mill. Mr. Erickin, the president, was in the counting room as the working girls filed in to receive their week's wages. Carefully he scrutinized each face at the little window until the last one had disappeared, when he turned to the bookkeeper and inquired for Morrow's girl, whose ever cheerful, modest, and smiling demeanor had often attracted his attention. He was told that she had left the mill because of failing health, and the matter was dropped for the time being, but the spirits, particularly gentle Lucy Aiken, and anxious Mrs. Morrow, were determined that the obdurate heart of this dignified man of wealth should be softened, and they were steadily working to accomplish their purpose. Weeks lengthened into months, and still Mr. Morrow languished upon his bed of pain, and still Katie drooped in her seat by the window where she sat striving to perform some needlework which one of her mill companions had procured for her, and which she persisted in doing, despite the protest of the doctor whenever he came to visit his patients. The last penny and the last appeal. Many times did the work drop from the weary fingers of the sick girl, while her frame shook with the spasmodic cough which seized upon her, until at length this kind of work had to be laid aside, and our young friend was obliged to remain idle altogether. In a very short time, every penny of the carefully saved, hard-earned little store of means was exhausted, and cold and hunger settled upon the little household. It was at this time that the dispensary physician, Dr. Jones, determined to see Mr. Aiken in behalf of his patients. The doctor found Mr. Aiken alone in his office, and made his errand known at once. He, the kind physician, related the fallen fortunes and present misery of Mr. Morrow, and his brave daughter Katie, to the stern-eyed man of wealth, who listened to the recital in silence. When he had concluded his story, he said, after waiting a moment in vain for word or comment from the millionaire, "And so, Mr. Erickin, I have come to see what you can do for this man who met with the injury that has made him a hopeless, helpless invalid while in your employ." "Ayo, do not see that I am called upon to do anything," responded the man of means. "The rule of the corporation is to pay all expenses of an injured employee for 10 weeks after the accident. This rule has been complied with in Miss Tomorrow's case, I believe." "Ayo, but, Mr. Erickin," interrupted Dr. Jones, "consider the circumstances of this peculiar case, for only a moment, and I am sure your sense of justice will prompt you to do something more for this unfortunate man. He was a steady, faithful, and conscientious workman, always at his post, ever discharging his duties with promptness and fidelity. Through no fault of his own, an explosion occurred, depriving this man of the use of his limbs, and rendering him an invalid for life. True, the corporation paid his expenses for a time, but health did not return to him, and when that supply ceased, his daughter, a young girl, nurse, companion, and housekeeper in one, entered the mill, and labored early and late until her health gave way, and she, too, became an almost confirmed invalid. I feel the influence of the spirit begins to show itself." "Ayo, the doctor, that will do," interrupted the rich man. "I cannot listen longer, as I have an engagement to meet in just 5 minutes. Here are $10. Give them to Mr. Morrow, and perhaps not positively, mind you, but possibly I may make it in my way to call upon him before many days." The doctor took the money tendered him, and retired from the presence of the great merchant with a sigh, thinking to himself, "Ah, well, it is true that corporations have no souls, And it seems to me that the individuals who form these corporations have very little ones. The pitiful sum he has given me will provide for the wants of my patients for a few days only, and I must cast about in some other quarter for assistance. I will again make application for their admittance to the hospital before the money is exhausted. They will have to be separated, but it cannot be avoided. And so musing he passed on his way. Sweet, gentle, Lucy Aiken. Mild and benign spirit, working for a father's enlightenment, striving to elevate the soul of a beloved parent above the selfishness of worldly interests and personal grandeur. She had no thought of allowing the matter to rest here, and she lingered by the side of that parent, filling his mind with thoughts of the suffering and destitute family whose circumstances had been so eloquently presented to him that day by his visitor, Dr. Jones, and causing him to turn in spirit toward that humble home many times, until at last, to get rid of the thing, he murmured, Mr. Aiken ordered his carriage and was driven down to the humble neighborhood of Morrow's tenement. The injured man lay stretched upon his couch in a passing paroxysm of pain as the merchant entered. By his side, leaning back in an easy chair, sat his daughter Katie, so pale, wasted and wan in appearance that she seemed more like a wraith that would vanish away at a touch than a human being. Mr. Aiken was startled at the sight that met his gaze, other suffering inmates, the extreme destitution, yet cleanly surroundings of that humble home, spoke more eloquently to this man rolling in wealth, and wrapped up in self-sufficiency, than 100 sermons on the poor could have done, and, strange to relate, while questioning the pallid girl concerning her own and her father's condition, his lower lip actually trembled with emotion. The spirit daughter's presence. Ah, this was a place where spirits could gather and perform their work, and Lucy Aiken came so near to Katie Morrow at this time that her presence quite overshadowed the features of the invalid, and reflected its expression and influence upon them, causing the face of the mortal girl to assume a striking likeness to the well-remembered features of the spirit, the loved and loving daughter of Mr. Aiken. It was this sight that thrilled the visitor with emotion, and caused his eyes to grow dim with unshed tears. At that interview with the invalids of Mr. Morrow and his daughter Katie, the proud heart of Mr. Aiken became softened as it had never been before. The time, place and circumstances exerted a strange influence upon him, for which he could not account, and he left, promising to send assistance, and also to come again, which promises were faithfully kept. A strong and capable female nurse was engaged to attend the sufferers, and arrangements were made with the proprietors of various stores to supply the family with whatever they required, without stint or question. Mr. Aiken found himself unable to remain long away from that humble abode. Again and again was he to be seen in the home of Mr. Morrow, questioning the suffering man concerning his malady, conversing with the invalid daughter in relation to her ailments, or speaking words of cheer to both. At each visit the likeness between Katie Morrow and the long-lost darling of his heart grew upon him. Ah, little did he know that it was the presence of his angel child that caused the marvelous likeness, and that at every visit of her father the spirit gained power to come closer and closer to him, or, indeed, that it was herself, dear Lucy Aiken, who filled her parents' mind day after day with the desire to visit these humble but worthy people. Happy results of spirit efforts. In a little while, under the generous treatment and kindly care bestowed upon them, both invalids began to show signs of improvement in their condition, and soon good Dr. Jonas, who still continued to visit them, and who looked upon the visits and assistance of the proud capitalist with silent but approving amazement, declared that, with the approach of early spring, it would be advisable to remove them to some country place where they could enjoy the fresh air and mellow sunlight. Accordingly, Mr. Aiken took it upon himself to provide such a place. A few miles from the great city there is a quiet, peaceful village, where the flowers bloom and birds make cheerful music through all the golden summer time. It is a lovely spot, where nature dons her fairest, freshest robes in which to charm the eye and delight the senses of those weary travelers who linger there in order to gain strength and repose of mind and body. In this pleasant spot, Mr. Aiken, the man of wealth, makes his summer home, And it was here he determined to find a place for Mr. Morrow and his daughter. By this time, Mr. Akin had enlisted the interest and sympathies of his wife in the case of the invalids, and it was mainly through her exertions that a pretty cottage located on a quiet lane, and partly shaded by the branches of a magnificent old elm, was secured for their occupancy. In due time our friends were removed to this pleasant retreat, and it really seemed that the change was calculated to work a marvelous cure in the condition of both invalids, so rapidly did they acquire strength in the genial atmosphere in which they now dwelt. In a little time, however, it was seen that Mr. Morrow's days in the form were numbered. The spinal trouble from which he suffered became aggravated to an intense degree, and all that could be done was to make his sufferings as light as possible by skillful treatment and care. All that kindness could do was done. Mr. Akin and his wife, who had grown wonderfully attached to Katie Morrow, spared no pains to make his last days peaceful and happy, and when his mortal eyes closed upon the scenes of earthly life, which they did in the latter part of August, it was with a knowledge that kind friends and faithful hearts were ready to care for the orphan child he was to leave behind. In the meantime, Miss Katie was slowly but surely regaining health and strength in the glow of the new life which had come upon her. Skillfully nursed and attended by her physician and waiting woman, petted back into health by the loving sympathy of Mrs. Akin and the thoughtful kindness of the merchant, the roses began to show themselves once again on her cheeks, her form and features became rounded out with new vigor, until at length Dr. Jones declared her to be no longer an invalid, and said that he would now restore her name to the lists of the hearty and healthy ones of the land. Each day Spirit Lucy Akin visited Katie Morrow, whom she had chosen for her medium, and through her instrumentality was enabled to come into spiritual communion with her beloved parents, although as yet they had no thought of such a thing. Already had the sweet spirit performed a wonderful work. By the influence she exerted upon her father, she had strengthened his higher nature and given it power to rise above the slough of worldliness, self-interest and cold indifference to others, in which it had been long submerged, and had so sweetened and mellowed his spirit, and caused it to blossom out in deeds of kindness and even loveliness, that Katie Morrow expressed herself, in contrite tones, to her friend Dr. Jones, for ever daring to think of dear, kind Mr. Akin as unkind and hard-hearted. As for the good physician, he was all wonder and amazement at the unaccountable change which had been wrought in the disposition of the wealthy merchant, but he took good care not to express his opinion before others, for he felt that here was something he could not understand. Nor was this the only labor accomplished by the sweet spirit. Hitherto, Mrs. Akin had been a restless, nervous, easily excited creature, a one who often declared nobody understood her since her dear Lucy died, and who had many times made her husband unhappy and uncomfortable by her forlorn repinings. But since she had come into communication with Kate Morrow and her invalid father, and had witnessed their patient endurance and fortitude under suffering, as well as felt the influence exerted upon her being by the spirits gathered in their humble home, this unhappy lady seemed to be a new creature. She became calm and tranquil, and in her care and solicitude for others forgot to remember self or to complain of her many trials. Thus did the work of the spirit spread, until it included these two humans in its loving embrace. The husband and wife seemed to understand each other once more. In these days they grew together, and, from consulting each other over the case of their humble friends, they began to counsel with each other over home affairs, until at last they appeared to be once again one in perfect harmony of thought and intention. It had been decided that, after the death of Mr. Morrow, his daughter Kate should enter the home of Mrs. Akin as companion and private maid to that lady, a decision that was agreeable to all parties, and which filled the mind of the dying man with content when he learned of it. Angel visits not few nor far between 3 days had passed since the death of the worn-out body, and it had just been consigned to the bosom of Mother Earth, that to rest forever. Katie Morrow and her friends, Mr. and Mrs. Akin, were seated in their private sitting room. The girl looked pale and exhausted from the effects of the trials of the last few days. Mrs. Akin was just thinking of advising her to retire to rest, and was looking at her for that purpose, when she was startled at beholding a change steal over the face of the girl. At first, the lady thought Kate had swooned, but in a moment she was undeceived. The face became transfigured and shone with an unearthly light, assuming the cast of features and expression of a man's countenance. Slowly they developed, until they appeared plain and unmistakable.